what's happening in most parts of the world where we, I mean, socioeconomic gaps are continuing to, widen, and new injustices are also being, new forms of injustice are also being fabricated. And in this context, I wanted to know, how did you see the role of, I mean, how do you see the role of researchers in the struggles and in the crafting of recourses against injustices in both the global north and the global south?
Right. So, I mean, one approach to this in a paper that I wrote with James Ferguson called Beyond the Proper Job, we talked about the problem of what Ferguson calls apocalyptic neoliberalism, right? This idea that everything everywhere is going badly and inequality and injustice is increasing everywhere. So it's definitely increasing in some places, but not in the same sectors, in the same places, at the same rate in every country, in the rural and the urban and the young and the old, etc. So, one role of researchers would be to be attentive to these differentiated histories and experiences in different places. So paying attention to place. I know you're very interested in space and place in your research group. And I think that gets a bit lost in visions of what Jim calls apocalyptic neoliberalism, as if everyone is being caught in the same apocalypse in the same way, or in fact experiencing an apocalypse. If you're in a prosperous smallholder in Indonesia, whether you're growing oil palm or rubber or whatever else, you may very well think that your life is getting better, not worse. And we need to be attentive to that, right? You may feel that your family situation is also getting better. Children have more education than their parents, and it's true, many of them don't have jobs, but some of them do, and there's still hope, etc. So, just being attentive to the range of different experiences in relation to socioeconomic gaps and new injustices, not homogenous in all spaces for all social groups in all countries of the world. So that's kind of one part of what a researcher needs to do, is to keep that in mind and not be too kind of sweeping in our assessment that the whole world is on a pathway to the apocalypse. But the second part of your question is like, what is the role of researchers crafting resources against injustice? And I think I'm probably inclined to be quite modest about the role of researchers in crafting resources. I mean, I'm not sure that I have really resources to share. What I try to do in my research is to pay attention to the kinds of resources that people are already crafting for themselves and putting to use, including the non-heroic kinds of resources I've been describing here. So, if researchers are only looking for collective mobilizations and claims for justice, they'll miss most of what people do most of the time, which is to try to survive. But they'll also miss the spark of action that's present in critique. So when someone says to us, we've become the audience, they are in fact speaking critically, right? They're stating that they do not accept the situation as just. So then the next question for a researcher would be, okay, so what are the formats in which a critical insight is shared? Do people share this critical insight? And if they do share it, what are the barriers that might prevent it from being amplified or acted on? So I wrote about this in an article which I called Politics Interrupted, in which I was trying to identify the blockage points that immobilize people or that limit their thoughts and expressions and actions. So that doesn't mean that I have an answer for how to remove these blockages, but I do think that if we as researchers are attentive to these sparks of critical thought and the potential for critical actions, the potential for people to mobilize, and we're also attentive to what blocks that, what makes the thought not be expressed, or expressed but not shared, or shared but not acted on, or I think this is an important role for researchers. It doesn't mean that we have answers, but it does mean that we can be alert to a world which is full of politics, full of critical reflections with or without actions, so that we then don't become, we don't take responsibility for finding the solutions and for knowing what people should do. But we are able to identify what people are already doing and accord value to their thoughts and actions, even when they're modest or indirectly expressed. So that's sort of as far as I think I would go. I myself, I don't think I have crafting of recourse beyond that. I wouldn't know how to do that as a researcher, from my role as a scholar.
I'm reflecting back again on your Indonesian case, and about this injustice without recourse and people's difficulty to find the feelings of helplessness. I mean, you didn't actually use that word, but that's kind of what I interpreted as I read your article about injustice without recourse, and it reminded me somehow of some youth, not all youth, of course, but some youth in the global north that are confronted to different injustices in their neighborhoods, or in their lives or education trajectories. And it reminded me, this your description of Indonesian rural communities. And that's how I kind of related it. I mean, I want to talk to you about this because, I mean, now we are, I mean, currently in France, we are in this forthcoming elections and a highly complex situation of these electoral processes ongoing and the ever-increasing scores of the far right parties, not only in France but in various parts of the world. And so that's why I wanted to ask this question, which is, I bet maybe a bit disconnected from your actual work in Indonesia, but still, this the book of Wendy Brown, which is called "In the Ruins of Neoliberalism: The Rise of Anti-Democratic Politics in the West." And I think this book, I wanted to talk about it and talk about this book with you here, where she actually explains that how the erosion of the nation state is happening in the face of this, neoliberal globalization, the rise of finance capital worldwide, and all this happening at the same time with disappearance of space for political and civic equality debates and concerns for public goods, And so she basically describes this whole process as what she calls the emergence of a deterritorialized and de-democratized sociality. So I guess it's not exactly the apocalypse that you just mentioned in the previous your previous response. But I somehow feel that the academic world is failing, and that's a very personal feeling, and I would understand people would be upset from this personal thought, but I somehow, sometimes I feel like the academic world is failing in addressing those issues and in connecting with channels of expression and dissemination of such debates with the general public, with a wider audience. And, or for the least, maybe it needs more inspiration. So I'd like to have your thoughts on this as well, and on how can your own analysis and findings from Indonesia inform people that are studying, such type of phenomena in other areas of the world and working in other academic worlds than the, anthropology.
Well, it's interesting, this description of, Wendy Brown's description of the kind of the deterritorialized nation state. Working in Indonesia, you could say that there never was that kind of nation state, which took responsibility for the welfare of its people. So the whole kind of liberal democratic period of Euro-American history, you know, is absent there. So people don't have, they never had really that expectation. At least in Indonesia, they didn't. So in some ways, you could say, you know, we're sort of arriving at the same point, right? That people are pretty much aware, let's say in Europe, or I have the feeling in Europe as they do in Indonesia, that no one's really looking out for them. No one cares about them. No one's taking care of them. So in that sense, it's almost come to the same or to a similar sense of being on your own, and having to somehow figure out how to survive without this assumption of a benevolent regime, you know, that will take care of your welfare. I mean, that could be a, you know, a point of kind of similarity. But in terms of what this would mean for us analytically, and what is the failure of scholarship, right? I mean, I think that I'm not quite sure how you locate the failure, but what I see is, at least in the work that I read, you know, as you know, I work mainly on kind of agrarian movements and land issues and so on. But I feel, and it's a bit reflected in the introduction to your volume as well, right? It's interest in collective action, that we're perhaps, that might be where we're failing, that we are attentive to those sites of action, especially when we agree with them. You know, when people are mobilizing around things that we want them, we think they should be mobilized around. But are we being equally attentive to the people who are either not mobilizing or who are mobilizing around causes that we disagree with and don't want to support, right? Because that surely has to be also part of our analysis. And, you know, when I read Wendy Brown's kind of characterization of this period of in American history, to me, it sort of lacks the ethnography. You know, it lacks, or where one could add would be in a more serious attempt to try to understand the experience, you know, of people who have come to distrust government or distrust science or, you know, I'm interested in their formation, right? Their social and cultural formation, their spatial and historical formation. I think we need to be interested in these people, you know, and interested in why they think what they think, why they do what they do. And I think that's where we've been failing, you know, by only attending to the kinds of mobilizations we like and not so much to those that we don't like. So I'm inspired in this direction of research. My inspiration comes from the British Caribbean scholar Stuart Hall, kind of cultural studies, a founding figure in cultural studies, who spent the decade in the 1980s trying to account for the massive popularity of Margaret Thatcher in Britain. He was trying to figure out what was it that she was saying and doing that resonated with such a large part of the British population, including people who had always voted for the Labour parties in the past. So, you know, he felt that it was important to try to understand that historical moment. And the terminology, the theoretical vocabulary that he advanced and that I've used, as you know, in my work, is this idea of articulation, you know, trying to figure out what are the words, what are the sentiments, what are the affects that she was able to express and render articulate that connected with or articulated with a certain political subject at a certain historical moment? Like, what was there that made her words resonate with her voters? And, you know, we could ask the same about, you know, Trump voters or in France, the voters for Marine Le Pen or whoever else, right? If we really want to understand this moment, we sort of have to do the field work, I feel, in order to understand why people are drawn to what they're drawn to, and So the at the I feel that there's a risk that we as scholars only study what we want to see, and we only want to write about it when we find what we want to find. And when it disappoints us, we're kind of lost, and we also lose interest. But I think that's where we have a lot more work to do to actually try to understand this historical moment in all of its contradiction and complexity. And in order to be able to do that, you have to move away from being the judge of what's, progressive or not progressive, or, and you also have to certainly move away from the suggestion you had in your previous question that we as scholars should be offering answers. I feel, and as a scholar, as a researcher, if I can generate some understanding of why people do what they do and think what they think, that's one step ahead. That's what I can do. That's what I should do. That's what we should all do. And I feel in the field that I work in, sort of agrarian, social, agrarian relations in the global south, but that's actually quite missing. There's a lot of, for example, not many scholars are interested in what I've been calling, what did I call them? Enthusiastic cash crop producing smallholders, right? People who want to grow oil palm, for example.
Although there are many, yes.
Sorry?
Although there are many.
There are many, and they're in very important actors in history, right? I mean, they're producing this crop just like they produced cocoa and rubber and everything before. But social movements don't love them because they're looking for an insurrectionary subject, right? Somebody who would be anti-capitalist or would be eco-friendly or would be dedicated to food sovereignty or food security, or, outsiders always think they know what people should do and what they should think. And evaluate the good stuff and then want to research the good stuff as they evaluate it, right? But I think that's a failure on our part, right? We have to be much more attentive to, like, okay, this is what they're doing, right? They're cutting down their rice fields and they're planting oil palm. So I need to understand why. Why do they do what they do? What are they thinking? What is their own evaluation, their own calculation? As you know, I wrote a book about this, about cocoa farmers, in my previous book, Land's End, trying to understand why indigenous farmers abandoned food production and went with both feet into cocoa. And all my activist friends said, oh, these people are crazy. Like, they're fools. They've made wrong choices. They should have preserved their customary land system and they should have preserved their food production. But I didn't want to judge them so fast, until I'd at least made an effort to try to understand. What is it that they knew? Let's assume, I just was rereading a little bit of Jacques Rancière, right? His sort of his foundational idea is, let's assume equality of intelligence. Like, I'm a smart person. I assume these farmers are smart people. They're as smart as I am, right? They know things. If they're making decisions, if they are going in one direction rather than another, let's not assume it's because they're idiots. Let's assume it's because they know things that I don't know. I just haven't understood their logic yet. So now I have to work harder to understand it. So I think that premise, the premise of an equality of intelligence, is really important right now, right? It'd be very easy to judge people who vote in a way that we disagree with, as fools. Somehow they're just lacking in intelligence. They don't see with the same wisdom and that we see, right? That's nonsense, right? I think we have to do work far harder than that to try to understand this historical moment. So I guess, I don't know if that surprised you either, but that's kind of like me, the ethnographer, just saying, we have a lot of work to do, and we fail as scholars if we only study what we want to see and only what we want to find. And then when there's a lot more that we need to understand.
I really appreciate this this comment on on the equality of intelligence and it really reminds me of my educational background in comparative agriculture, where the core of our the approach we have when we study farmers is that they have reasons to do what they do, actually. They have good
Yes.
reasons, even not only reasons, they have good reasons. So but I guess what I wanted to talk about in when I talked about failure was maybe not so much about the choice of topics, but I do agree with what you say, and it's really inspiring and super interesting. I guess it was more, I mean, when I talk about failure, it was more like how in the our failure to connect with other channels of communication, which are not, part of our role per se, but but maybe this role still to connect, to generate debate. It's maybe not so much about doing things in the place of, of activist or whatever, but more in the I guess in sharing and somehow sharing and connecting with channels of dissemination, I guess, or
Right. Yeah.
to generate debates,
You know, I since publishing this plantation book, which just came out a couple of years ago now, like Pujo and I said, well, what we've uncovered is such a disaster, such a catastrophic disaster for the Indonesian people for generations to come. You know, a third of their agricultural land in corporate hands, permanently and without end. You know, we have to do something about this. Like, we have to somehow intervene in this. And of course, we quickly realized how poorly equipped we are to do that, you know, and how much we lack, to some extent, even the skills to do that. So, you know, we set about trying to write for popular Indonesian newspapers and news magazines. You know, we gave talks, but and you know, in one of the talks we gave in Indonesia, in Jakarta, it was in the National Science Council. A woman came up to me afterwards saying, you know, thank you for this talk. Quote, I had no idea. You know, urban people have no idea what's going on in the countryside of their own nation. So, how do you even, you know, let alone having people in Europe be interested in what's happening elsewhere in the world? People within their own country, and I know you work in Myanmar, Celine, right? So, you know, people living in Rangoon, I mean, how much do they know about what's happening in parts of their own country? Not much. So it's a problem at every level, urban to rural, and also, you know, north to south, and then academic to popular. I mean, you're right that there's like 1,001 failures of communication. You know, we tried to put some provocative pieces into public circulation. One piece that I wrote on corporate impunity, you know, basically the essay was, why do Indonesian oil palm corporations treat the law as optional? You know, why can they get away with disregarding the law? And that piece in the Indonesian version immediately had 75,000 views. It caught some popular sentiment in Indonesia among Indonesians, that corporate impunity is a problem, right? And then other things we've written about the oil palm question have had no uptake at all. So, you know, sometimes it's maybe you just catch the right thread, the right vocabulary, perhaps the right moment. But I think we're not very skilled at this, and people who work in media are much more skilled. So in writing that piece, I was coached by a journalist who is extremely skilled and was able to understand the content. I mean, he works in the same area, knows what I'm trying to say, but also had a journalist's skill in saying, ah, too much detail. You're going to lose your reader. This point has to come first. You know, it took a lot of coaching to take an academic like me and make something media savvy and actually successful, you know, read, widely read. It's not something I could have done on my own. So, you know, I think there's lots to to do and say here and that. But I'm also of the opinion that we don't all have to do everything, right? Some people are better as researchers, and other people are probably better as popular writers, you know, people who have that skill. And I don't feel I have to do everything. There's room for lots of different approaches, but yes, you're right. Failures of communication, absolutely. It's like, it's so weird. We're in a media saturated environment, and yet we're not talking outside our own circles. That's what I think of the sort of
It's the
creativity
communication
versus.
and connecting to other people beyond the academic sphere, I guess.
Yeah, and it's not easy to do. And you know, even in my field, anthropology, you know, many writers these days are sort of hyper invested in theoretical debates, and I am too, right? I've written, tried to write in ways which are theoretically astute and creative and so on. So I'm also invested in those debates, but I try not to let them dominate to such an extent that a reader who's not invested in the same debates will just read one paragraph and say, this book is not for me, you know? So I was actually struck in this, your introduction to your special issue, like it's hyper textual, right? You start by, I hope you don't mind this friendly observation, right? But it's very much intra scholarly. You're debating with other scholars. There's loads and loads of people cited. So a popular reader would not have a clue what you're talking about or why this issue is important. And you're not, of course, at all unique in writing like this, right? I mean, in part, it's the academic game that we're in. And it's also our audiences and the people that we write for and who are engaged in these debates. So I think we need to have these spaces, scholarly spaces, where we speak as scholars to each other. And I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with doing so, using a scholarly language. I'm not at all sort of anti-theory in that sense that, you know, we should only speak in words of two syllables. I mean, no, we need a technical
Sure, of
vocabulary
course.
and we need spaces to do that. But maybe that's not the only thing we need to do. You know, maybe there's other kinds of writing and other formats which also are needed. So, you know, that's just something I think we're all working on in different ways.